It's all bluff from top to bottom.
Here's Pat Bluff, former governor of the state of Arizona, who's with us on our show, Policemen Meet the Nation.
Yeah, just to me, studying it, it looks like the whole system of life is bluff. A man just bluffs himself out of the cradle onto the floor, just bluffs his legs into carrying him around when he gets sick of crawling.
This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight is writer, performer, recording artist, Firesign Theater member, David Osman. And we're talking about a new Firesign Theater record release, Dope Humor of the 70s. David, welcome to the show. It is such a real pleasure to be able to talk to you.
Well, I am happy to be there with you in this wonderful universe where we can only be with each other at a distance anyway.
I know. Now, let's talk about this new recording, Dope Humor of the 70s. What is this? And I was listening to some previews of it, and it seems like all material that's never been released before.
Well, it's I liken it to like a sketchbook. You know, you have a sketchbook, it's got 120 pages in it. Maybe you like, you know, here's 30 really great ones, you know.
Yeah.
They're like pages from a sketchbook. The total number of hours is 80 hours of radio. So back in the day, 50 years ago, because we couldn't get any airplay with a 38-minute album, why I decided that we needed to do something, so I edited with razor blade and, you know, glue.
I go back that far in radio myself.
Yeah,
I remember the reel-to-reel Ampex tape recorder, and then just with two hands going, and then you would cut it with a razor blade and tape it together.
That's right. Well, I did that for all of the Dear Friends album, the original two.
Oh my God!
Two LP album. I did all of that editing, and that album went out, and it got airplay, which was good. Now our archivist Taylor Jessen, who's been making sure that we are completely and thoroughly represented, decided that we needed an LP release. It's just the time for it. We love the idea of a 2-LP release means a 24-by-12-inch album. I mean, you know, four, so one, two, three, four, and an insert, and I mean all this wonderful stuff that goes along with having an LP. So these are Taylor's cuts, similar to the way that I made my cuts. And he had one more. Well, he had two more shows because I just had Dear Friends, and he had Let's Eat, which was the show after Dear Friends, and the Hour, which was the show for Dear Friends. So this is 38.
Man, you're still making me laugh. You're still making me laugh.
2 hours out of 80 hours of radio. We covered the waterfront, man. I mean.
The interesting thing is there's a live sound to this album because occasionally you're breaking each other up.
Well, that's the goal, you know. I mean, we all loved it, no matter what radio we're listening to. If you're listening to, you know, like go back as far as say Jack Benny was.
Oh yeah.
Wonderful when they broke each other up. The Goon Show. Nothing was funnier than when Spike Milligan would drop in unexpectedly, some line, and everybody would go up. Everybody. And the wonderful thing about radio in those days was that you didn't know what the audience was laughing at.
Right.
But you laughed anyway.
That's right.
Obviously, it was funny, whatever went on. And so, yeah.
Well, you know, and I want to pick a small bone about the title, A Dope Humor. Yeah, well, I lived through that era. And I'll tell you, the more I listen to it, and I've been re-listening to a lot of the Firesign Theater material, I just thought it continued in the sort of the arc that was begun by the people you talked about. That there was always interesting radio and recordings. And this just happened to be the one that really best represented that time period. Because I can listen to it today, and that stuff is wicked funny. I mean, and it's brilliant. And it also paints a picture. Like, you felt like you were there.
That was it when we were there. And the more that I listened to our material and the more that we managed to reissue it, particularly this early period you can call the psychedelic Firesign, which
yeah.
would be 66 through 72, there's hours and hours of radio. There's all of the four or five albums. There are innumerable there's movies. There's an incredible amount of material that that explains the time.
Yes.
And be bold enough to say that I don't know anybody else besides famous newscaster Walter Cronkite, who was there for everything. I mean, we were there for everything. Personally, I was there for Kennedy's election. I was on the air for Kennedy's election.
That's
I was on the air for Kennedy's assassination.
Are you talking you actually reported it?
Yes.
Oh, man.
On the radio as a, you know, in my 20s at KPFK in Los Angeles. So, and we all bring an enormous amount of history of our own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Each one of us was very different. Even the two guys who went to Yale, Peter Bergman and Phil Proctor, you know, Phil took a corner turn and became a really funny actor. Peter took another turn and became, you know, the most brilliant guy I ever knew, you know.
And you continue. We're going to talk about this a little bit further down the line, but
sure.
You went on and did a lot of radio theater, like serious radio theater. You did productions of things like Red Badge of Courage, Wizard of Oz, and stuff like that. So you continued with this this what I would call oral, A-R-U-L-A, A-L, oral theater.
A-U-R,
excuse me. But that, I mean, you continued doing that and actually doing more and more ambitious projects.
Oh, yes. Once we realized that, of course, the Firesign realized how successful it would be to make movies for your mind. During the 80s, when the Firesign was not working primarily, the three other guys were doing whatever they could do to keep us, the name, alive.
Yeah.
I was working for WGBH and then working for NPR, or NPR first, I guess, and then GBH, and doing these large-scale, what we call radio movies. My wife, Judith Walcott, and I started that at WGBH.
Which is right here in Boston. We're an NPR affiliate.
I know you are. I know it was right there, and we did... You know, this was 13 episodes or 12 or whatever you had to produce in those days when everything was even. And we did these very two-hour radio dramas, some of them produced, some of them reproduced.
Wow.
In an attempt to do what the BBC was doing with their two-hour radio slot. We found that, in fact, American radio stations were not really terribly interested in broadcasting two-hour
spots. Why am I not surprised?
But here's what we did. We applied for and got an NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, a grant, and took it home with us and did the War of the Worlds 50th anniversary production entirely in digital, the very first digital radio theater production, authorized and bought from the original author, Howard Koch, and from that point on decided that we would do as many of these as until our time lasted, as long as our time lasted. I mean, I think you get 5 or 6 years before you have to come up with another idea, you know? And so we had a great run of beautiful, beautiful, big radio shows.
Wow.
We Hold These Truths, which was Norman Corwin's anniversary of the Bill of Rights, which we literally fought through Congress. Literally, Teddy Kennedy got us that radio show. It was, and the story is unbelievable. It's really incredible, creative, a story of American arts plunging through to recognize the most important part of the Constitution. And we were working with Norman Corwin, who really invented radio theater back in the 40s, and had been a hero of mine all my creative life. First radio script I ever read was by Norman. It was called The Odyssey of Runyon Jones. The star was an 8-year-old, and I said, I want to play that part. And, you know, and I was 12 at the time, so I was a little old for it.
You also did an arts magazine for NPR in 1982 called The Sunday Show, where you were the executive producer and host.
Yes, executive producer is kind of a misnomer because I didn't really know how to do that.
Well, I was going to ask you because I never know what that title means.
Yeah, it was a useless title. I accepted it because I always wanted to host the show. Obviously, I wanted to host it. Why wouldn't I? You know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even back in the 80s, that it was before NPR was really, really, really big. You know, it was still the biggest audience I could get to on a weekly basis. So they hired me pretty much on the basis of the Fireside Theater.
Huh.
I ended up in a I got a corner office finally when I insisted on getting out of the corridor. Literally no one would help me do anything. I was given a 5-hour once a week slot. And I was in Washington D.C. and knew no one. I screamed, I yelled for help, and Deborah Lamberton, who was a producer at NPR, became my producer for that show, introduced me to everybody who was then producing, and suddenly I had a team of 17 people doing 5 hours of Arts Magazine, literally every week.
Tell me what kind of things you would have on that show.
Oh, well, the plan was to go to, I'll give you an example. The plan was to go around to the NPR stations at the time. We did one. We went out to San Francisco, did 5 hours of Bay Area programming, some of it live. I remember it was Dave Grisman live in one of the segments. In another segment, went to Oakland. It was the opening of the Oakland Paramount. And we did a pre-taped piece there. Another one, we went to the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina, Charleston.
Yeah.
And we spent 3 days. Connie Goldman, wonderful, wonderful NPR radio producer, the only adult in the room for a while. Connie and I went down to, with Deborah Lamberton, went down to Charleston for 3 days, recorded all 3 days, including doing interviews, doing recordings of concerts, just covered it. Deb did a carriage tour of Charleston, you know, which is one of those things. So we did all of that 3 days, ran back, edited it for 2 days.
No, and I just want to stop you right there. You're editing old style, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. My God.
This is when All Things Considered was done with 10 reel-to-reel machines, each one of them with a 10-inch reel on it with a minute or 2 or 3 minutes of tape.
Oh, my God.
It was wonderful to watch them do that show live, and I had a director the same thing. She just danced her way through the show. They just stood there and danced the way, and go machine one in, take one in, get ready for machine two, and we have 17 seconds counting back. 14, 13.
I love this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great. Another example, let's see, Charleston, we also went to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, and did, you know, the arts of Santa Fe, which were including doing a tour of a bronze casting, artist doing bronze casting, which we followed all the way through from the original to his final approving of the piece. You know, great, you know, documentary stuff, you know, be there live stuff. We had arts news, and I guess I should end up by saying why I didn't do this for more than a year. 26 programs. The last program was to celebrate John Cage's 70th birthday.
Yep.
Cage had been a great influence on me, on the Fireside Theater, on the arts in general, and I thought, and I knew him slightly. And we met on a few occasions, and so we commissioned him to write a piece and broadcast it. We were very careful to explain how this was like, you know, not Beethoven.
Right.
You know?
He plays things with insect wings. I mean, that's the great thing about John Cage. I mean, he would create things that involved 17 minutes of silence.
Yeah, well, what he did for us was to have six. This is in the old days. We had a satellite. We had uplink six stations to the satellite. His instructions to the stations were to go, let's say, 5 inches down the fourth shelf, pull out the fifth record, put it on the turntable. And so it was mixed live, everything that any one of these stations had. So you heard spoken, you heard jazz, you heard folk, it's an amazing thing.
I was going to say, did it swing? Did it work it out in the end?
I have just had it dubbed.
Oh, nice.
From cassette, which I think it's just about the only copy there is.
Is there any chance?
Taylor, who dubbed it, said 15 domestic minutes, it's called. Taylor said, it is fantastic.
Is there any chance that can get released?
Yeah, I'm going to put it up. I'm going to put it up on YouTube.
Yeah, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My special guest tonight is writer, performer, recording artist, Firesign Theater member, David Ostman. And believe it or not, there's a new Firesign Theater record release, Dope Humor of the 70s. Where is this going to be available?
Well, the LP version is available from Stand Up Records and any place else, you know, that you buy records. It's a two disc set, plus there is a secret code inside which will allow you to get like another hour and a half worth of material as a download.
Wow.
Plus there's a really, really good biography of Firesign that Taylor has put inside, and a number of Phil Proctor collages.
Nice.
It's a really, really nice package. There's also a download version of it that has a lot of illustrative material. Now when we release downloads, we do it with a lot of things of the time,
yep.
Script copies, all that kind of thing that go with it. So what I do like to say about this is the only album that had its commercial written 50 years before it was released.
How did that happen?
It's Austin's commercial originally, and when we're doing those radio shows, any one of us would bring in scripts for all of us to do, and we'd simply improvise our way through them, sometimes throw them away completely. And and we had an engineer, the live Earl Jive, who was the fifth crazy guy for that radio show, and he would just throw in sound effects, reverb, a train would suddenly come running through. Oh, guys, I guess we have to be on the train now, It was wild. It was totally free-form radio, and we knew when we were doing it that it had never been done before.
Yeah.
It was so tightly controlled.
I want to ask you, how did you meet, and how did Firesign Theater start?
There's the fundamental question. I can say it pretty quickly and pretty easily.
You almost sounded like George Leroy Tyebrighter there for a second.
He almost walked in the room. I chased him out. George is going to be 100, And he is, talk about dropping a load on the giant toad. We're going to bring out about 6 hours of Tyebrighter material, plus we have rediscovered a video of a live Tyebrighter performance of his old radio show, Hollywood Madhouse. So it's going to be a wonderful, rich package. We're going to bring that out for his 100th.
He's got a long history because he ran for vice president in 1976.
He did indeed. It was an epic journey. there was a convention in Santa Barbara.
That's right.
There was another convention in Lawrence, Kansas.
So wait a minute. How did you guys get together?
Okay, how did we get together? We got together because Peter Bergman arrived in Los Angeles at KPFK during a fundraiser. He was an immediate hit and raised a lot of money. Phil Austin and I were raising money for the station at the same time, KPFK in L.A., which was the only then public station, non-commercial, listener-sponsored. So Peter got a late night, like 11 to 2 a.m., radio show. He was immediately a hit. He was fantastic as an air personality. He absorbed everything that he came in contact with, and it was a call-in show. So he immediately began to attract the underground, the teenagers, a nighttime audience in Los Angeles of people who maybe had smoked a little pot instead of being drunk, you know? So I listened to his show regularly and dropped into the station where I used to work. Phil Austin was his on-air producer, so he was there most nights with Pete. And Phil Proctor, who went to Yale with Peter, discovered him accidentally and as a total surprise during covering the Sunset Strip riots in 1966.
Right.
And so he came to see Pete. They got together on the air. We'd spent some time on the air. And one night, the four of us were all together in the KPFK studios. Peter said, I've got a great idea. Let's do a film festival. And he thought, that's good. Film festival on the radio. That's a funny idea. And we each got to play two other characters. And so there were six of us and Peter. And we showed our movies. I was a guy from Latin America named Mario Estonato, and Mario liked to make movies by tumbling cameras down mountainsides. It was very psychedelic. The movement was fantastic. It was a great experience, and he had just done a Panavision movie down the Andes that, you know, went on until the camera broke. He was very excited about it. And Phil, of course, had a Russian movie that he was talking about, and finally came down to Phil Austin. And Phil was kind of a strange person. And we all showed little bits of our movies, and he put on his movie, which was called Blondie Pays the Rent. Peter immediately shut it down. Peter said, well, we can't show this. We can't show this movie. This is pornography. We just can't show this. Well, the phone rang off the hook. People said, this is the liberal audience, I want you to know. People said, you can't shut that movie down. What is it, censorship on KPFK? How dare you censor anything? My darling friends, it was not real. It was on the radio. It didn't exist. So we realized and looked at each other after this was all over and said, well, they'll believe anything we say.
Uh-oh.
And which was certainly, that's how Ronald Reagan got to be president, you know. So it was really a powerful moment in that sense.
Oh, my God.
The jump then was that Peter promoted the first Love-In, which was held in L.A. It was huge. We moved to KRLA AM. A border-to-border 100,000-watt radio gets you from Mexico to Canada. And suddenly, it was Radio Free Oz was a giant, much gianter hit. And we ended up doing a series of shows at the Magic Mushroom, which was a club,
mm-hmm.
On Ventura Boulevard. Still there. The building's still there. We did 12 night shows, Sunday night broadcasts, and out of that, and out of the currency of being local heroes in L.A., Peter was called by a producer at Columbia Records and offered a record deal, right? And he said, well, I don't want to do. They've been offered an astrology album. He said, I don't want to do an astrology album. I have this comedy group. The comedy group, you know, I mean, none of us were at a comedy. I was working for ABC Television. Phil Proctor was in a Broadway show, you know. Phil Austin was working at the radio station as a literature and drama director. You know, he didn't have a comedy group, but he did because he flew, the Columbia Records flew Proctor into L.A. We all ended up at Peter's. And he said, we're going to write a comedy album called, Waiting for the Electrician.
That's right. Somebody like him.
And that's what we did.
Did you have any clue that this was going to go off the way it did?
Hard to
say. At what album did you realize you've achieved something special?
Well, we knew, you know, the first year, that album, that Electrician album, was released at the beginning of 68.
Yep.
And we had to go on the road. We were a rock band, remember?
Yep.
So we had to go on the road to promote our album like every other rock band. And that's how we were, that's as far as Columbia Records was concerned, we were a rock band. We just didn't sing a lot. And, yeah. So we had to go on the road. We performed. We did a lot of work that year. And it just didn't happen. And so by the end of the year, you know, we were all doing something else and moving on by the end of 68. And then suddenly our contract was picked up because an executive named John McClure at Columbia Records said, I love these guys. I'm going to put them out on the classical label if you don't put them out on regular Columbia. And so some other executive decided, oh, no, we'll keep them here. Well, that was the album that became How Can You Be in Two Places.
This is the one when you're not anywhere at all. We're completely out of time, David, and I feel like I've only begun to ask you about your past. And you've done so much. Like, I wanted to talk to you about the Sullen Arts, and maybe we can talk another time. But you've done so much in radio and in theater, auditory theater, and you've even written books of poetry. But we want to promote the fact that there is a new Farsight Theater collection coming out, Dope Humor of the 70s. My special guest tonight is writer, performer, recording artist, Farsight Theater member, David Ausman. David, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Mark, and I'd love to come back.
I have like a lot of your other projects I want to know more about. But you're also like a historian of radio, too, of doing that kind of sort of theater production on the air. And that's an important history. But thank you so much for your time. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch.
Here's Pat Bluff, former governor of the state of Arizona, who's with us on our show, Policemen Meet the Nation.
Yeah, just to me, studying it, it looks like the whole system of life is bluff. A man just bluffs himself out of the cradle onto the floor. He just bluffs his legs into carrying him around when he gets sick of crawling. And